an opinion. I know he is. Maybe it's not as bad as I think. I mean, I know it is, but maybe it isn't. Lord Damaris clears his throat.
I think it looks rather nice.
Something inside me bursts. I pop up straight, shifting my knees beneath me so I can stare over the back of the chair into the darkness in that corner of the room. I can just discern the silhouette of my so-called bridegroom standing there, and I hurl my words straight at him like knives. That's the whole problem. It's rather nice. But that fabric is not meant to be turned into something rather nice. It's supposed to be exquisite. The most exquisite, most perfect gown ever dreamed. A feast for the eyes, a joy to look upon, a delight to every sense. Instead, it's just that. I gesture furiously with one arm. Rather nice. I'd rather it were utterly and abhorrently offensive. At least then it would have a reason for being. He turns toward me. I can't see him, of course, but I once more feel the intensity of his stare on my face. The heat of anger roaring in my veins turns into a hot flush burning my cheeks. I've never in my life given way to such a fit of passion, not even during my initial fear and rage the night of my kidnapping. All this over a dress? What a fool he must think me. I duck back behind the chair, sitting heavily with my feet out in front of me. I hear him coming and hasten to smooth the folds of my skirt. I even run my fingers through my loose, wild hair, though it does no good. The flush in my cheeks burns brighter. I've let myself come undone, revealed a side of myself that even I hardly knew existed. It feels so vulnerable, like I'm exposed somehow. I swallow hard and try to inhale slowly to still my racing heart, but I can't. He returns to his seat just beyond the edge of the moon firelight. I shoot quick glances his way, my gaze not quite comfortable resting on his shadowy form. I hear him sit, hear him heave a very faint sigh. Then his voice rumbles again in the darkness.
Perhaps I can help you. What do you need in order to make the gown exquisite?
Though I just resolved to compose myself, that resolution crumbles under the weight of his question. I groan and cover my face with my hands, pulling at the skin under my eyes. I don't know, I moan. I don't know. That's the whole problem, isn't it? And worse still, it's not even true. My words pour out as if a dam in my soul has broken and nothing is left to hold them back. It's like I do know. I do. It's in there, in my head. The knowledge of what this gown needs, but it's... My hands grip the hair at my temples, pulling hard. I can't reach it. There is an image. There's a knowing, but it's just beyond my grasp. How must I sound in his ears? Like a madwoman, no doubt. I don't know how better to explain this frustration, this pain, this ache. It's going to drive me mad, I finish in a whisper. Slumping deep into my chair, I abandon all concern for posture and poise. A pincushion that fell into the seat corner jabs uncomfortably into my hip. I push it out and fling it into the moonfire. It rolls right up to the white stones, but doesn't catch fire. The pale blue flames lick around it harmlessly, glinting on the little silver pins. I wish I'd never set eyes on that god's blighted cloth, I mutter. Only after the words leave my lips do I realize how loud they are in the stillness. A swift dart of shame pricks my conscience. After all, the cloth was his gift to me, and a truly magnificent gift at that. A gift so perfectly selected to bring me delight that it almost frightens me. Anyone with sense would be pleased by the richness of that gift, but few indeed would know the true worth of it as I do. And here I've gone and throw it all back in his face with my petulance and ingratitude.
My lips part. Am I going to apologize? Anything I might say sounds so insipid in my head that I can't quite bear to speak it out loud. I shut my mouth again, pulling my lips into a tight line. Suddenly, I'm aware of something. A tension in the air that wasn't there a moment before. It feels like... I look up sharply and glare across my work table at the shadow-filled chair beyond the firelight. Are you laughing at me? I would never. His voice chokes slightly, then goes rough and low, but with an edge to it that betrays his mirth. I see that you feel it most keenly. I wouldn't dream of mocking such pain. Uh-huh. I roll my eyes and toss up my hands helplessly. Fine. I know I sound ridiculous. It's just a dress, after all, but... But you don't know how excruciating it is to be so close to something so perfect, so beautiful. To feel it almost there, almost within my grasp, and yet... I quickly clench my jaw before an expletive escapes. I've disgraced myself enough for one night. I won't add unladylike language to my heap of shame. Instead, I clench a fist and pound it on the arm of my chair. I can't explain it, I finish with a sigh. I just can't. It's beautiful. The laughter is gone. Instead, his voice holds a low, humming rumble like the deepest note of a bass-stringed instrument. It simmers with power, vibrating in my gut so strangely that it momentarily shocks me. But I give my head a quick shake and cast him a baleful stare. Don't try to take back your words. Rather nice. That's what you said. Rather nice is not the same as beautiful, and I won't be placated. He chuckles again, but that musical, rumbling hum underscores the sound. It sends a shiver straight down my spine, but the sensation is not unpleasant. Quite the opposite, in fact. I press back into my chair, wishing the wingback would fold in around me and hide me from his invisible gaze. I hear the shift of his weight in his chair and sense that he's leaning toward me. That's not what I meant, he says. The dress. I am not one to judge such things. I lack the ability to tell the difference between nice and exquisite. But I know a great deal about magic and, if you'll excuse the word, about passion. I blink at that word. Should I say something? But what? He continues relentlessly. I sense such passion in your spirit. It's unlike anything I've seen before. The Fae, as you may know, are neither artisans nor crafters. Our only creations are illusions. Even our most magnificent palaces, edifices of glory throughout the ages, were built by others. We can boast only laying claim to them and holding them as our own. The passion of a true creator. Now that is a sight worth seeing. The passion radiating from your spirit, bright as the Kinsatra itself, surrounds you like a halo, an aura of pure power. It is. You are. Dazzling. Dazzling? My mouth hangs open. I'm dumbstruck, stupid. Dazzling? I've never in my life been anything of the kind. And well, I know it. I rarely go out in company, and the few times I did go, I was the quintessential wallflower clinging to the shadows while other, brighter girls called attention their way. I have no conversation, for my life and experiences have been too narrow to allow me any developed interests or opinions. I am so far from dazzling. It must be a joke. I sit up straighter and pointlessly shove one hand through my hair. Now you're making fun.
Indeed, I am not.
The words burst from the shadows, almost pained in their intensity. All the laughter is gone from his voice. I stare across at him. Am I seeing things? Or did he just reach one hand out to me, but think again and retract it from the moonfire light?
Valera, he says.
My heart quickens at the sound of my name from his lips. I'll never get used to this sensation, that pulling of the cord connecting us. My breath catches.
Valera, if you had the freedom to pursue this passion of yours, if there were no fetters, no encumbrances, what would you do?
No one has ever asked me such a thing. What does it matter what I would do? I do what I can. Nothing more, nothing less. And I have no time to ponder dreams or fancies. I set my chin and narrow my eyes. I would return to Brielle. Though my words are firm, they sound hollow, empty even. But that can't be right. All I want, all I truly want, is to be reunited with my sister. Right? Lord Damaris shakes his head, the heavy shadow moving slowly.
That's not what I asked.
I feel the weight of his question, his true question, a question that has prodded the edge of my heart for many years, but I've always shoved it away, refusing to face it. What would I do in a world without the responsibilities I bear? A world in which I could choose my own path, pursue my own passions, a world where I was truly free. I stop, afraid of the answer trying to work its way up my throat to the tip of my tongue. Instead, I give an answer that sounds good, but reveals little. I would take an apprenticeship, become a proper seamstress. Then I would open a shop.
And this would?
He hesitates, as though carefully choosing the right word.
This would satisfy you.
I shrug. It would fulfill our needs. He breathes out a word I don't understand. I do, however, understand the exasperation in his tone that makes goosebumps rise across my flesh.
But what would satisfy you?
He urges.
What do you truly desire, Valera?
There it is. He's gone and used my name again. Gone and pulled unfairly on that cord between us, drawing me toward him, drawing my heart, my soul. Why must he do this? Why must he try so hard to know me? Surely it can't matter. He needs a bride, and he needs her for a year and a day. Anyone would do, anyone willing to sit out her time and fulfill the parameters he's set. Surely there's no reason for him to push for more than that. There's no reason for him to peel back the layer upon layer of protections I've gathered around me throughout the years. But when he speaks my name, I can't help it. I feel my defenses weakening. I feel the depths of my own vulnerability. It frightens me, and yet I can't deny the pleasure of the sensation. I stop and swallow, wetting my dry throat. If there were a world in which I could make such decisions for myself, if it were possible, then I would spend my days exploring the possibilities I've begun to explore with this gown. I would, in this imaginary world, I would have endless supplies of beautiful fabrics and trimmings, and endless time to do with them as I willed. I would create works of art for all manner of people, lovely, plain, even ugly. As long as my clients trust my eye and taste, I would dress them all magnificently, discovering that which will reveal their true beauty. This is dangerous. I should never give my thoughts such freedom. They'll run away with me, and where will they ultimately lead? Only to dissatisfaction, disappointment, even despair. But now I've started, I can't seem to stop. If I had the freedom, I would discover possibilities others have not yet begun to search for, to see where the modes of the present and the ideas of the past may meet and become something new, something extraordinary,
And I would never allow a pattern or a fashion plate to determine the truth, but only the individual garment itself. I would let it show me what it is meant to be, and then I would make it so. I can see it now, all those airy visions that have danced along the edges of my imagination for years, only to be dashed by the crushing realities of day-to-day existence. Oh, I should know better than to indulge like this. Suddenly, movement draws my eye. The moonfire has sunk low on the hearth, casting a dull glow. Lord Damaris, taking advantage of the darkness, reaches across the space between us. I feel his outstretched hand, though I cannot see it. It hovers in the air before me, and I stare into the space where I know it must be. Valera, he says. I try to breathe, but can't seem to remember how. Valera, if I could have one wish granted in this moment, I should wish to fulfill this dream of yours. If I were free, no fetters, no encumbrances, I should like to see your magic unleashed, to witness it in its full glory. For truly, I do not think there could be a more beautiful sight. My heart strains, pulling inside my chest. It wants to answer the call it hears when he speaks my name. It wants to reach out through this darkness, to search along that cord of connection, to find out what might happen if that connection is truly realized. I want to take his hand. No. No, this can't be real. I can't really be thinking this way. But I am. The urge is there, so strong. I can't ignore it. I want to take his hand, to feel what his fingers are like interlaced with mine. I scarcely know him, this faceless Fae, my kidnapper, my prison keeper, this man who has in so short a time discovered more of me, the true me, the real me, than I even knew existed. This man who has seen me at my worst, furious and rude and despairing and petulant, everything a lady should always suppress, always hide from the public eye. He's seen me, unadorned and unmasked. And he finds me beautiful? It's not real. It can't be. It must be a trick. Why can't I believe it's a trick? Why am I so tempted to let my hand glide across that empty space between us, to rest in his? It would be too easy to give in. I push back into the seat, firmly tucking my hands under my arms. With a wrench, I pull my gaze away from the shadows where he sits and stare into the remnants of the fire. My unburned pincushion seems to taunt me where it sits, all the little pinheads flashing like so many accusing eyes. Lord Damaris withdraws as well, sitting back in his chair. The quickness in the air between us lessens, and that tightness around my heart gives way as the cord relaxes. Suddenly, I utter a little gasp. "What's wrong?" Lord Damaris asks. Nothing. It's just... I lick my dry lips and huff a little smile. I think I've figured it out. What's wrong with the gown, I mean? I sit forward in my chair, twisting to look back into the dark corner where the dress mold stands. It's too dark in the room to see it, and I won't be able to work on it properly until morning. But a weight in my soul lifts, slowly at first, then more swiftly as the new idea clarifies. Inspiration begins to flow unhindered once more. "I'm glad." My bridegroom's voice draws my attention back his way. He sounds sincere yet again. He always does, which is what makes him so frightening.
"Magic like yours cannot be dammed up for long."
I shake my head, facing his shadow self again. "I've told you already, I don't have magic."
"So you say."
He stands then, and I hear the movement of his robes as he offers me a deep bow.
I will leave you now. You must desire to contemplate these new ideas in peace. Good night, milady.
I stand, though I feel foolish to bother with such formality after the unladylike behavior I've just exhibited. I bob a quick curtsy. Thank you, my lord. Good night. When he's gone, I sit back down in my chair. I'm tired. So very tired. I'd not realized how exhausting frustration could be until now that the frustration seems to be lifting. I want to think about my gown and mull over this new plan I have to fix it. But instead, I find myself thinking about that voice. That deep, rumbling hum. That powerful timbre that sets my heart racing and my skin tingling with sensations I scarcely dare name.
You are dazzling.
I open my eyes wide and stare into the darkness right in front of me. It seems as though I can just perceive the outline of a great outstretched hand. What would have happened if I'd been brave enough to take it? 17. I spend the next several days working on the new dress. Several times I almost despair of bringing the ideas in my head to life. Several times, as I pick seams apart, I fear the fabric will be ruined and believe I've spoiled it all. Several times I come close to tossing the dress mold through my glass window in a rage. But these emotions, deeply felt and horrible though they are all part of the ultimate joy. And joy there is aplenty. Joy, the like of which I've felt only the barest glimmerings before now. As the days slip by, I learn to open my heart to that feeling, to not fear it. Lord Damaris persists in his nightly visits. He asks after my day, inquires about my work. After our last encounter, I am reluctant to answer. He can't truly be interested in the complications of bindings and linings and fell stitching and drape, all vitally important to me, but painfully dull listening for anyone not in my trade. But when my answers are short, he presses for details, for further explanation. Bit by bit, he draws out my words until several times I lose myself entirely and become caught up in the thrill of explaining my work in detail far beyond anything he can possibly enjoy. Until I realize what I'm doing, flush, and hastily bring my wordiness to a halt. Then he says,
"Go on. What about this and such?"
And I'm off again, carried away with enthusiasm for my craft. Sometimes I've stopped to wonder, why does he listen so attentively? Why does he return night after night for more of what surely must, from his perspective, be mind-numbing conversation? I'm not exciting. I know that well enough. I could never be a success at Lady Leoken's dinner parties. I'm too shy, and much too obsessed with my own small world of needle and thread. And yet, Lord Damaris's attention never flags or fails. If I didn't know better, I would almost describe him as captivated. But no, in the dead of night, after he has come and gone, I lie alone in my bed, rubbing my calloused fingers together and forcing my thoughts back into proper order. He is not captivated. Far from it. He has need of me, and that need is best served if I am happy and compliant. This is the truth, and I must not forget it. Even if I want to. I heave a sigh and roll over, tucking into my pillow. I won't think about Lord Damaris. I won't. I force myself to think about home. Home with Brielle. Home in that cold house we can't possibly afford to keep up while we slowly freeze and starve. Home, where every day we must dread encountering our father on a back stair or in a doorway. Home, where my life is made up of a Stitch Girl's drudgery and desperation, fear, and loneliness. When I return to my proper life, when my imprisonment ends and I'm back where I belong, all this inspiration, all this joy that I now give free rein will have to be dragged back under control, whipped and beaten into submission. The real world is much too hard a place for dreams, for joy. But it's a world with Brielle in it, which matters more in the long run. Eventually, sleep claims me, and despite these somber reflections, I rise at daybreak reinvigorated for the tasks before me. I can't help myself. Perhaps this is a temporary joy, but it may be all the joy I'll ever know in life. I aim to indulge. So I measure, pin, hem, tuck, line, and trim, and slowly, the gown blooms before my gaze like a rose unfurling its petals. One day, it's complete. The end comes upon me quite suddenly. I'm applying neat little stitches to the neckline one moment. The next, I'm snipping the end of my thread, taking a step back, and realizing there's nothing more to do. The dress, while far from perfect, well, not exactly as I'd seen it in my mind, has become what it was always meant to be. It's breathtaking. I can't even smile as I circle the dress form, my gaze lovingly surveying my work. This is not a moment for smiling. This feeling is too big. This satisfaction too great. I come around to the front of the gown, fold my arms over my chest, and nod once, decisively. "Job well done," I whisper, allowing myself that much self-praise. Now if only. I bite down on my lips as though I can bite back the thought, but it's there, insistent, prodding at my brain. If only I might see it on a living person, not a mold. If only. If only I dared try it on. That evening, I eat more than I have in I don't know how long. Now that the frenzy of creation has passed, I'm both tired and ravenous. The goblin men keep heaping my plate, laughing at me as I tuck in, and holding their own pot bellies to indicate how fat I'll grow. I roll my eyes and flick grapes at them, which sends them scampering around goblets and ducking behind bowls of fruit, before re-emerging to shake their tiny fists at me. Night steals softly upon me. I return to my room and collapse in the upholstered chair by the hearth, my bare feet sticking out in front of me in an attitude of absolute exhaustion. Back home, I always ended my days at Mistress Petrin's worn to the bone, my eyes bleary, my head aching, my shoulders cramped. This is a different kind of fatigue, a much more pleasant sensation. I've done good work, really good work, entirely born of my own mind and wrought of my own hands, with no help or interference from another soul. If I could bottle this feeling and hold on to it forever, I would.
"Milady."
I startle in surprise. I hadn't heard the door open. Hadn't heard Lord Damaris enter. "My lord," I say, trying to sit up properly in my chair. But why bother? He's already caught me in this ungraceful sprawl. It hardly matters now. I wave a hand vaguely into the space behind me and say, "It's finished." He doesn't take his usual seat. I listen to his footsteps as he approaches the dress mold. Can he see the gown in the near darkness beyond the firelight? Apparently so, for I hear him grunt. It isn't much, but it's definitely an approving sort of sound. I smile, and something warm glows in my breast. He returns to the fire and assumes his seat just beyond reach of its light. I can just see the shape of his legs sticking out before him, crossed at the ankles. It's the most relaxed I've ever seen him. An oddly comfortable sort of silence fills the space between us, and the blue fire on the hearth seems to dance cheerfully on its white stones.
"Will you wear it?"
he asks at length. I pinch my lips into a hard line. I don't know. I want to. Oh, how I want to. But some part of my heart still resists. It's not as though I have anywhere to go. He's silent for another long moment. Then,
"Did you often have opportunity to wear fine gowns? Back in your own world, I mean."
"What? Me?" I chuckle and shake my head. "No, certainly not. We didn't move in those circles." My voice sounds bitter. And I don't want that. Not tonight. Not after what I've accomplished today. Hastily, I add, "I'm not one for dancing, anyway. I rarely even made it to the village dances, and then I only watched from the outskirts."
"Glorindal night is coming."
I blink and cast a glance his way. "Is it?" I hadn't realized how swiftly the time was passing. Glorindal night had been a month away when I left home. It's a night of celebration throughout the kingdom, throughout the worlds. A night of equal importance to humans and fae, dedicated to the memory of the marriage between Glorafina and Andalius. A union blessed by the great goddess herself in ages of old. Glorafina was a fae, and Andalius a mortal man. According to legend, their love brought about the end of the bloody Silver Wars, which had wreaked havoc on the worlds for generations. It's not uncommon back home to glimpse the fae among the village dancers on the green on Glorindal night. Wild shadows, half unseen in the moonlight, filling the air with their laughter, which intoxicates the senses like wine. Human maids are usually strictly warned against dancing with the fae. But not on Glorindal. On that night alone, they may safely join hands without fear or treachery, for not even the most wicked fae will break the sacred trust forged by Glorafina and Andalius. Last Glorindal night, Brielle begged me to take her to the village green. Despite my best efforts, she slipped out of my grasp and plunged into one of the dancing circles. When I finally found her again, close to dawn, her eyes were alight with fire, her face flushed, and her bare feet bloodied from too much dancing. She slept the next day and night straight through, but woke refreshed and full of vim. When I asked what happened to her, she could offer only the vaguest answers. "It was awfully fun, Valley," she said with a merry, mischievous smile. "Wicked fun." I smile a little at the memory, even as a sharp pang passes through my heart. Where is Brielle now? Safe at home, tucked into her bed? Or out beneath the spreading trees, searching through thicket and glen, trying to find a way into fairyland? Lord Damaris's dark voice rumbles in the darkness, interrupting my train of thought.
"My people always celebrate Glorindal night on the dancing lawn in the garden."
"Oh? The lawn just beyond the fountain?" I ask. Since I first glimpsed the great circle of lush green grass overlooked by the massive fountain with its heroic figures and monsters wrought in gold, I thought it would be the perfect setting for a dance.
"There will be music. Orican boasts many fine musicians. And food and drink."
I blink. "You mean here? There's going to be a Glorindal night party here?"
"Not here, exactly. But in another fold of here, yes. You will see them only as shadows. But by moonlight, you may glimpse a little more. And I can arrange it so that the music carries through."
My mind spins, trying to catch up with what he's saying. Are you inviting me to attend? He clears his throat, and I see the indistinct shape of his leg shift as he adjusts his seat.
Only if you like. I will, of course, remain unseen and need not trouble you with my presence. But if you would like to experience a taste of the festivities, I rather think you would enjoy them.
He pauses again, then adds tentatively,
You might wear your new gown.
I lace my fingers together. I suddenly realize just how slouched into the chair I am and push up into a more graceful position, straightening my back and shaking loose locks of hair over my shoulder. Thank you, my lord, I say uncertainly. I will consider it. He grunts in acknowledgement. A few minutes later, after a few more unrelated comments and stray observations, he rises and makes his exit. Suddenly weary, I undress and collapse into bed, tucking my head deep into the pillow. But I lie awake much longer than I like to admit. My eyes shut, but my mind full of images of dancing shadows under moonlight. I'm listless after finishing the gown, having fallen prey to the lethargy and malaise that accompanies the end of a creative fit of passion. My fingers itch to be working, but I can't summon the energy to start any new, less thrilling project. Eventually, after I spend the morning prowling my rooms, lingering in a scented bath, picking at the food Ellie brings me, and trying not to look at my dress for fear of finding some fault in it, or worse still, picking it apart for no fault at all, I allow Ellie to drive me from the room to take a stroll. I intend at first to walk in the gardens, but change my mind and make my way to the courtyard instead. Lord Damaris told me my very first night that every door of Orokin was open to me. Why not test his word and see a little more of my enormous prison? Starting from the courtyard, I choose a passage branching off from the colonnade and set off. It proves to be one I walked before, the corridor leading to the open window overlooking the waterfall and the moonlit landscape far below the towering cliffs. Better prepared this time for what I'll see, I approach the window and gaze out on that sweeping vista. It's undeniably beautiful and terrifying. The bizarre sight of night and day skies pressed up against each other with no twilight between makes my brain hurt. I don't linger over the view. Instead, I try some of the doors lining the corridor on one side. They all open at my command, and I peer in on a series of impressively beautiful and ornate private suites. Bedrooms with adjoining bathing chambers, much like my own. Many of them are even larger than mine, boasting sitting rooms and massive dressing rooms stuffed full of the most elaborate garments imaginable. Each suite boasts unique touches, testimony to the individuality of each occupant, no doubt. One of the suites exhibits a motif of birds that repeats itself in the wall hangings, curtains, crown moldings, woven rugs, and even many of the gowns. Another of the rooms is decorated entirely in weapons and instruments of the hunt. A third room belongs to a musician. Instruments lay every which way, and a massive silver harp dominates the center of the sitting room. It's much too large an instrument for any human to balance and play, and I can only imagine the magnificence of the musician to whom it belongs. As I wander from room to room, my curiosity grows. These chambers have an oddly lived-in feel to them, yet the house itself is apparently populated by no one other than Ellie, a few other green-skinned nymphs I catch occasional glimpses of, and dozens upon dozens of goblin men. None of these rooms feel right for those beings. Maybe the people of this house live in a different fold of reality? As I enter the next room, I catch a flicker of a shadow. Lord Damaris? No. This shadow is too slim and feminine, nothing like the broad, towering apparition I've come to associate with my pseudo-bridegroom. Maybe I really am catching glimpses through the folds and into the reality where Orokin House is still inhabited, not silent and nearly abandoned as it is here. Can the shadows see me too? Do I appear as a shadow to them? Disconcerted, I back out of the room and command the door to shut behind me. Without venturing into any more of the rooms along that corridor, I return to the courtyard and pick another passage to explore. This one leads through massive, pillared halls and galleries, open spaces filled with light from skylights overhead. Small clusters of fine furniture break up the floor space, and I can almost imagine the graceful forms of fey men and women strolling among the potted plants at their ease, enjoying conversation or other entertainments of the day before gathering in the courtyard to feast. Feeling small and mouse-like, I wend my way to another big window at the end of this series of rooms. It's clear glass, so I look out and blink in surprise. A view of the ocean spreads before me, its white-capped waves lashing under a violently stormy sky. It's as unlike the view above the waterfall or the garden walk as it can possibly be. "Another fold," I whisper, backing away and shivering. How many times has Orokin been folded? How many realities does it touch? A bit disoriented now, I take a turn, thinking it will lead me back to the courtyard, but it brings me to a truly massive hall under a domed ceiling. Ahead of me are two enormous doors. A front entrance? What sort of world waits just beyond those doors? Curiosity and trepidation mingle into a single, unnameable emotion. I approach the doors, biting my lips and twisting my skirts in both hands. "Open," I say softly, not quite certain I want to be heard. The doors obey at once, gliding silently outward on their hinges. A still, solemn forest stands before me. There is no road or path. Gigantic trees grow right up to the door, gnarled roots pushing up through the stones of the doorstep. They're so huge, and the shade they cast is so deep, I almost think it's night outside. But here and there, patches of sunlight make their way to the forest floor, filling the world with a green and gold aura. Solemn stillness holds the air captive without even a trace of distant birdsong to interrupt. It feels familiar. Is this Whispering Wood? I swallow, my chest tight, my head suddenly spinning. It feels like it might be Whispering Wood, as if this part of reality might stand on the edge of my own reality, my own world. Brielle would know. Brielle spends so much time in Whispering Wood. But I've only ventured beyond the edge of the tree line once in my life, back when I was quite young, before Mother died. I was so scared that I ran out again almost at once and never wanted to go back. I take a step, then another, until I stand on the edge of the doorway. What if I were to step outside? Could I run through those trees and leave this world behind? Escape Orokin and Fairyland altogether? If I did, would I be able to find my way home? Or would I wander lost in the massive forest until I succumbed to starvation or fell prey to wild beasts? Is it worth the risk? I look down at my feet. One step will take me over the threshold. One step. Suddenly, the shadow is there beside me. I feel rather than see his arrival. I look to my right and find that tall, broad, but faint outline of a man just beside me. "Have you come to stop me?" I ask. My voice sounds strangely loud, ringing through the stillness of that waiting forest. He's silent. Of course he is. A shadow cannot speak. I think he moves one hand, but he's too indistinct for me to say for sure. I sigh and step back. "Close," I command, and the doors swing shut, blocking off my view of the forest. "Don't worry, I say, feeling the weight of the shadow's unseen gaze. I'm not prepared to brave the wilderness on my own. Not yet, anyway. I wrap my arms around my middle and turn, intending to go back the way I came. But I'm a bit twisted around in this large, open floor plan. Which way did I come from? I'm as lost as I would be in any forest. The shadow moves to my side, pauses, then continues slowly as though expecting me to follow. I shrug and walk with him, believing he'll take me back to the courtyard. Instead, he leads through a series of arches and magnificent rooms until we reach a set of arched double doors. Here he pauses. "Can't you open them yourself?" I ask wryly. I speak a word of command, and they part before me. I blink, surprised. He's brought me to the chapel of the gods. He glides through the opening, but I linger, peering up at those great figures on their pedestals. I feel suddenly shy, afraid to step into their notice. But the shadow moves to the center of the aisle and stands, waiting for me. Straightening my shoulders, I hasten to him. We walk down the aisle more slowly than I like, making for the curtained exit at the far end. My skin crawls under the awareness of those stony gazes, and I find myself drawing unconsciously closer to the shadow. "I saw you here, you know," I say after we've progressed a little way in silence. "On my first day, I followed you into the chapel. That is, I think it was you. I saw someone, a shadow like you, kneeling in prayer before the great goddess." I look up at him, studying the indefinite blur of darkness that is his face, wishing I could gain some sense of his expression. There's nothing, but I can't help thinking there's a quickening of interest in the air. "I wish you could tell me the truth," I continue. "I can't help feeling that my purpose here goes beyond you and your curse, that there's more at stake." I sigh, my brow furrowing. "I wish I knew the whole story. I wish I knew if I could forgive you for what you've done, for kidnapping me." The shadow is harder to see here, just a patch of slightly darker space in an already gloomy chamber. Does it exist in another fold of reality? Does it struggle to see me too? Can it hear anything I say? I was able to reach through realities at least once that I recall, the time it gave me Brielle's letter. "I wish I knew if you were good." My voice is scarcely more than a whisper. "I want to believe it. It's difficult for me. I don't know if what I'm feeling is true or am I merely falling for treacherous fae manipulations? I've always been told they are subtle beyond all reckoning, but I'd never imagined cunning like this. He treats me with such consideration. He worries about me. He seeks to understand what makes me happy, then does what he can to give me happiness. He listens. Then he asks questions and listens some more. I've never been treated with so much kindness. And until now, I'd never realized how starved I was for it. For someone to care about me. My interests. My hopes. My passions. My needs. And what baffles me more is the fact that the more I open up to him, the more I reveal of who I am, the more delighted he seems.
"You are dazzling."
I close my eyes, fighting against the memory of that voice, which is still far too clear, far too present inside my head. It frightens me, the way he said those words. And even more so, the way he acts, the way he treats me. I could so easily begin to believe such kindness is real, to trust it, even to depend on it. But that... no. Kindness is an illusion, a most dangerous illusion. I dare not trust him. no matter how I want to. I drop my head to stare down at my feet, at my worn slippers, so drab on that floor of inlaid precious stones. My throat thickens, and I blink, surprised at this sudden upswelling of emotion. Gods above, what am I doing? Quickly, I lift my head and firm my jaw, looking at the dark blankness where the shadow's eyes ought to be. For a moment, I hesitate, uncertain what to say. I know my own way back to my rooms now, I speak at last. Thank you. With that, I turn sharply and hasten on to the end of the chapel, fleeing the stony gazes of the gods and the unseen gaze of the shadow who is my husband. 18. If that was Lord Damaris who walked with me through the chapel of the gods, he doesn't bring it up when he visits me that night, nor the next night, nor the night after that. His visits are never long, or rather, if I'm honest, they're not as long as I should like. He enters my room, speaks his usual simple greeting, "M'lady," then sits. He asks me questions about my day, which I answer, sometimes curtly, sometimes with more enthusiasm. One night I tell him of a recent interaction with the goblins, how I found myself in the ridiculous situation of trying to keep one ugly little man from stealing the trousers off another ugly little man's head. I tell the story with zeal, my hands and arms broadly gesturing, and as I reach the crescendo, he laughs. It's such an unexpectedly warm sound, bright and spontaneous, like the sun bursting suddenly through heavy winter clouds. Surprised both by the laugh and the sudden rush of heat flooding my cheeks, I drop my arms and fold my hands in my lap. I look away from the shadow in the chair across from me, gazing instead into the dark space off to the side of my fireplace. Silence falls, but a silence still ringing with the echo of both my own voice, runaway with enthusiasm for my tale, and Lord Damaris's outburst of mirth. Is he as embarrassed as I? It's impossible to tell. That shadowy formlessness gives nothing away. Suddenly, he speaks.
What is your sister like?
I look around sharply. My sister?
Yes. I know you love her dearly and worry about her safety. And I gather she is not very like you.
No. A soft chuckle escapes my lips along with a smile. She is nothing like me. She is very brave, fearless to the point of recklessness. She hates all that is cruel and rotten in this world and would throw herself in opposition without a thought for her own safety. Many times when Father, I stop. One hand moves to my cheek. I had to protect her, you see. She couldn't protect herself. He is still, too still. But something moves in the air between us, and I feel again that strange sense of connection, like a cord tied around my heart and stretched taut and invisible through a dimension outside time and space. In that vibration, I sense a sudden, strong, and terrifying anger.
He beat you.
The words come out rough, like a growl. He is a broken man, I say. I pick at the threads of embroidery on the arm of my chair. They've become tattered since my arrival. He loved with all his heart, and then his heart was broken, and he has only pieces left. Pieces that hurt him, cut him from the inside like knives.
You make excuses.
No, I shake my head. No, there is no excuse for what he does. But there are reasons. A long silence follows this. Then, in a voice even darker than before,
you love him, despite all he has done to you.
I lift my chin, glancing at the shadow, Yes. The word comes out softly.
Why?
If I don't, who will?
Maybe he doesn't deserve love.
He doesn't. I shrug. Then I repeat simply, he doesn't. What more can I say? I can't explain myself. It isn't something I can put into words. Have you heard anything of my sister? I ask after some moments of silence. You said you would send someone to watch over her.
She is well,
comes the swift answer.
Just as you predicted, she tries to pass through Wandfriel. That is, Whispering Wood, as you know it. But I have sent my servant to deflect her. She can pass only so far into the forest before her path inevitably turns her around and leads her home again. She is...
He pauses as though trying to find the right word.
Frustrated.
He finishes at last. I smile and sigh mirthlessly. No doubt she is. Poor girl. Poor foolish girl. The moon firelight dances and flickers, casting its bright lacy pattern through the filigree screen. I watch it dance, wondering if perhaps it's time to call an end to this evening. Instead, on impulse, I say, "What was your brother like?"
"My brother?"
he blurts, sounding startled. "Yes, it's only fair. If I must talk of my sister, you must tell me something of your brother. Were you close?"
"As close as two brothers can be. Inseparable, you might say."
I hear layers in his voice. So many layers. Sadness, joy, anger, and more. More than I can possibly discern. "I'm sorry," I say. "I didn't mean to pry."
"No. No."
I think I see the shadowy shape of a hand raise in a gesture of compliance.
"No, it is good to speak of him. It has been a long time. A very long time."
He sighs heavily, then says,
"We called him Terrell. That wasn't his true name, you understand, but the name he was known by. In our language, it means terror. And it was well earned, though only in the best sense, you must understand. He was a maker of mischief, but there wasn't a drop of cruelty in his veins. He loved animals. The more deadly and dangerous, the better. When we were still boys, he snared and brought home a lamia cub and convinced our mother he could tame it, make a pet of it. But it was insatiably ravenous. And though it grew fat on the fine meats and fruits and other delicacies Terrell fed it, it was never enough. Finally, one day, in a bid to supplement its ravenous appetite, it tried to eat me."
He tells the tale as if it were a fine lark. My eyes widen with horror. "What happened to you?"
"My mother plucked me from the monster's jaws, stunned it with a blow of her hand, and ordered Terrell to haul it back where he'd found it. I was scarcely 30 years old at the time, but I remember like it was yesterday."
I smile and snort. 30! Such a baby.
"Indeed.
We truly do come from different worlds. Your mother sounds very brave."
"I never thought to meet a woman her equal."
The words hang in the darkness, so bright with pain and with love, I can almost see them suspended like little jewels strung on silver threads. I feel a question bubbling up in my throat, and on impulse, I let it escape from my lips. "How did they die?" A long silence follows. In that silence, the cord of connection between us tightens. A sensation so strong it's almost physical and painful. My hand creeps to my own heart as though I can touch that cord, grab it, pull on the tension to make it relax somewhat. And still, the silence extends. Have I offended him? "I shouldn't have asked that," I say. "I'm sorry."
"Don't apologize."
His voice is sharp, but there is no harshness in it.
Is he in pain? I peer across at him but can see only the usual indistinct massive shape in the chair.
I'm trying to think of a way to answer, he says at last, but I cannot.
So, their deaths were part of this curse, part of the secrets that hold Orokin captive and keep its master in the dark. This is, in itself, a revelation. I see, I whisper. I will have to ponder how this connects to the other few bits and pieces I've managed to pick up. I see, I say again, my voice trailing off. Soon, Lord Damaris rises.
I will bid you good night now, milady,
he says. I nod and murmur, my lord. He crosses the room to the door, which opens at a silent command. There he pauses. Briefly, I see the silhouette of his body and an unnerving impression of horns.
Tomorrow night is Glorindal,
he says. His voice is tentative, even a little shy.
I will be down at the dancing lawn until sunrise. You are welcome to join me, if you like.
I perch on the edge of my seat, gripping my knees with both hands. Thank you, my lord. It's neither an acceptance nor a refusal, merely an acknowledgement.
Sleep well, milady,
he says. Then he is gone. I'm oddly agitated the next day. I can't explain it. The few times I force myself to sit in my chair and try to unsnarl this tangle of emotions, I'm immediately unsettled by a complexity of thought foreign to my experience. I jump up at once and resume pacing the room, trying to force my brain to settle, to fix on something, anything other than him. Though I had promised myself I wouldn't, I fiddle with the gown. Adjust the trim along the neckline, only to change my mind and put it back the way it was. Play with the length of the hem, pinning up layers to see how they fall, then shaking my head and removing the pins, hoping I haven't damaged the delicate fabric. Finally, Ellie drags me away from the dress mold and out of the room entirely, burbling firmly and waving her antennae so severely I haven't the nerve to protest. I take a walk through the upper reaches of the garden, keeping well away from the reflecting pool, the fountain, and the dancing lawn. Instead, I stroll through a waist-high maze of flowering shrubs, pretending as I go that my eye isn't darting after any flickering shadow, searching for a phantom apparition that isn't there. Birds sing sweetly from the trees, and a brightly plumed thing with a long, needle-like beak sits on the head of a statue in the center of the maze like an elaborate, living hat. It watches me warily, its expression faintly accusing. What? I demand of it, planting my fists on my hips.